The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Anger grows at the government after Tuesday's catastrophic explosion in Beirut. 3 days of national mourning have begun. 137 people are known to have died, with thousands more missing or injured.
The Labor Department says the U.S. economy added nearly 1.8 million jobs in July. It did beat expectations from 1.6. The unemployment rate fell to 10.2%.
Russia says it's ready to approve the world's first ever coronavirus vaccine by next week. But actually, large-scale trials will only begin after the slated approval. That decision is raising widespread concerns that the safety of the vaccine might be compromised in an effort to be the first country in the world to get a vaccine approved.
The retail bankruptcies continue to mount. Lord & Taylor, Men's Warehouse, the latest big names added to the list this week. The mounting bankruptcies could spell trouble for the commercial real estate market as more and more retailers break their leases.
What's interesting about gold is it's starting to become everything to everybody. People like it because it's defensive. People like it because it's a reflationary trade. People like it because it's inflation protection. So what you're starting seeing is the narrative about gold is starting to be like the narrative about big tech. It gives you everything. So that explains why you're seeing some basic, important structural allocations in favor of gold going on.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
In today's edition of Financial Sense News Hour, Dan Wontropski provides his technical outlook on the stock market, including a very important update on precious metals. He says they're definitely overextended, but that listeners want to be looking for pullbacks to buy into a bull market. Also, Dr. Frank Notaff from CoreLogic discusses the U.S. housing market, which he says, like the stock market, is being fueled by record low interest rates, some of the lowest rates that we've seen in history. And to wrap up today's show, Chris Poplava joins us for another edition of Smart Macro to talk about our own outlook at Financial Sense Wealth Management and where he would be putting money to work in today's market. First, here's Ryan with this week's market wrap-up.
Thanks, Chris. Let's start off with some of the key economic reports this week, which continue to point towards reopening and recovery in the face of growing COVID cases in hot states. And that's a real win. The economic reports this week, I think, were also helpful in seeing performance from some of the cyclical areas and stocks, while interestingly, Treasury yields continue to fall. But actually, there was a nice rally at the end of the week. Starting off with the ISM reports for manufacturing and services, let's start and take a look at the manufacturing report, which was up to 54.2 in July from 52.6 in June. Anything above 50 is an expansionary reading. And when Chris and I were looking at the report Monday and given the three contractions from March to May, it showed some real promise given the increase in new orders inside that manufacturing data, that it's just not a flash in the pan. You know, services increased to 58.1 in July, up a tick, and the third straight month improvement and the highest reading since February 2019. Looking inside the report, the employment index fell as business activity improved, which shows a little bit of a hesitancy in employers to hire, given the uncertainty still surrounding COVID and consumer behavior. But still, a nice trend there in services. Factory orders increased 6.2% for June versus May, with a 3.4% increase in orders for non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, showing businesses picking up overall. And initial claims had a big drop, which was much better than expected, dropping 249,000 claims to 1.186 million. So some real progress there on the unemployment claims side of things. Things have been elevated there for quite some time. Like, for example, a year ago, it was 214,000 total. So, again, nice to see a substantial drop there. The jobs number was good, adding 1.763 million jobs, and the unemployment rate improved to 10.2% from 11.1% in June. So great reports overall, and they seem to influence the Treasury yield some at the end of the week. The 10-year yield got to a recent low of 0.515%. 0.5% on Tuesday, but closed higher on Friday's jobs data, up to 0.562%, which, again, like I said, a real nice change there. Treasury yields have been falling since early June. Tech resurged as market leadership since Apple's earnings last Thursday, among other tech names, Amazon, etc. And we continue to see great responses in the semiconductor space to that leadership. And because some of Intel's production issues may allow others to gain some market share, according to some of the analysts like Jefferies, who increased their price on AMD this week. Unfortunately, Western Digital on Thursday didn't participate after a drop of 16% due to earnings. Part of the issues there was a weak September quarterly guidance, with concerns still around COVID could resurge and disrupt its supply chain. And their dividend, which was huge, and one of the reasons we used to own the stock a long time ago, their dividend was suspended last quarter, and still no news about it being reinstated. So that hurt Western Digital. Seagate, its rival, also gave downside guidance last week too. So the combination has the market concerned somewhat later in the week. There's also been some growing concern over two more news items I'd like to share. The Democrats and Republicans are still at odds over a coronavirus support bill. A lot of views on that is that we may not see something for another couple of weeks still. And there's growing concern over this because enhanced unemployment benefits, I believe, have already ended. I think that was $600 a week. And direct stimulus payments and small business loans will not get out to those right now that need it. And many people are depending on that relief, given they're out of work or business is depending on the support because they have low demand or they're closed. The second issue is relations with China continue to deteriorate with the sanction on Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam and Trump's recent executive order to ban TikTok and WeChat in 45 days unless there's a sale of those services. Again, TikTok is in discussions, I believe, with Microsoft. Apple has denied any kind of discussion about purchasing TikTok. So right now it's Microsoft and TikTok. On the recovery front, more vaccine trial news out this week, and I won't bore you with all the details as it didn't really move the market too much. And we've been hearing this kind of news for the past few months since April. What did help the stock market was Disney's earnings, which pushed the Dow nicely on Wednesday, mainly due to some cost savings, which is mainly based on a deferral of rights costs owed to the NBA and MLB as games were postponed to later this year. So, of course, those costs have also been deferred, which isn't the best news, but it did help the stock quite a bit, in addition to a lot of new streaming offers that Disney's Plus, one of them I think is called Star, which will begin next year. And that is offering programming from ABC, FX, and Freeform. And then I think they've taken Mulan, which is a live action flick, and I think they're bringing it directly to streamers on Disney Plus versus obviously releasing it in theaters, but they will be charging a pay-per-view for that one in particular. One last thing to mention, the U.S. lifted its advisory against international flights, which helped airline stocks, again, beaten up by COVID substantially. And, you know, we've heard from many in the industry talking about it. We won't see 2019 levels for a few more years. But that's it for me this week. On the wrap-up report, I'll review the earnings season numbers a lot more from a higher angle in a couple of weeks, as at that point, we'll have a really good chunk of companies that have reported, maybe at the end of next week, for the season overall, and we can maybe have a better view of how things are going besides some of those estimates I gave last week. And they've definitely been giving a wind in the sails of the stock market, helping soar prices higher along with the good economic reports this week. Goldman Sachs this week said they think the S&P could climb another 11% higher when there's actual official vaccine news and release of an actual vaccine. And I think that's a good call, given a lot of the industries hurt most by the pandemic are still kind of languishing and a spread out of the performance from growth and technology into those other areas hurt, I think would really round out this rally and make it a lot more healthier. But if you look at the advanced decline line on the New York Stock Exchange, this rally is steady as she goes after taking out the recent June highs. And again, obviously, some wonderful performance coming in commodities, based off of more relief coming from Congress eventually when that comes through. A lot of performance there, but careful chasing. We saw a bit of a pullback on Friday as the move has been extended. Back to you, Jim, with the technician, Dan Wiatrowski. Very interested in what he has to say about how the market's trending right now and given where strength is.
Paul, your most recent book is The Race for 5G Supremacy, something that we've been discussing on our show quite often. Why China is surging, where millennials struggle, and how America can prevail. Where does 5G fit so prominently in the race between the US and China today?
Okay, so 5G is good for two things, for extremely large amounts of data and for very inexpensive applications across a wide array of activities, largely in the area of industrial, logistical, and commercial applications. And China now has basically a connection in, right now in August, probably up to 200 cities, and they're heading for 350 cities coming up by the end of the year. We still don't have any 5G rollout in the United States, and that is a big problem.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, this stock market seems unstoppable. It's just about everywhere you look. Bonds are doing well. Stocks are doing well. But one commodity in particular, actually several, are doing even better. Let's find out where this is all heading. Joining us on the program is Dan Wiatrowski from Janney Montgomery Scott. Dan, let's start with the stock market. I'm looking at the Dow, and we have the industrials confirming with the transports. But my goodness, when you look at the NASDAQ and you look at the S&P, explain the lag there, and will that change?
Yeah, no, that's funny you had mentioned that, because we almost want to see the Dow confirm with Amazon, quite frankly. I mean, it's certainly new economy here. So, you know, what we've seen, there's certainly a lot to talk about here, but we'll try and keep it brief. The, you know, post-COVID-19 market crash and the recovery that we have seen thus far is very pointed, obviously, to certain sectors of the market, and folks are calling this new economy versus old economy, so on and so forth. But what it's setting up is a pretty notable divergence, right, between leadership, which, as you mentioned, is, you know, large cap technology, mega cap consumer discretionary, like a new economy stock such as Amazon or maybe some of the FANGs, and really the rest of the markets. Now, everybody has recovered off that March 23rd bottom, but the leadership now has taken such a commanding lead relative to the broader markets. Just to give you a sense of this, the NASDAQ Composite and the NASDAQ 100 Index are both making new all-time secular highs versus the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is still well under its February 2020 highs. The S&P 500 faring a little bit better than the best, still below its prior 2020 highs. Those two actually coming along nicely. Where we see further divergence, and something that I think investors just want to take note of, is when you go down the cap scale and you move into benchmarks like the NYSE Composite, which is one of the broadest gauges of our market, then maybe down to the Russell 2000, even a small cap 600 indices. It's very interesting where the NASDAQ is up, I think, 22% year to date now, and quite an amazing rally. The small cap S&P 600 is still down about 12 or even 13%. The Russell down 7, 8%. Even the Dow is still down on a year-to-date basis by 3 or 4%. S&P barely just nudging into positive territory over the last couple of weeks, up maybe 2%. So the reason we bring this up is because we've seen a little bit of this story before. We saw divergence in the market in 2006, 2007. We saw a bigger divergence in the market, certainly between tech and the broader markets, back roughly between 1998 and 1999. Now, folks that know their history know that those years that I just put out there, 1999, 2000, and then maybe 06, 07, those were pretty sizable market tops before major corrections. Now, that's not the call we're necessarily going out with here right now, but we do think that if this divergence persists, in other words, you keep having the NASDAQ, you know, make new all-time highs. You have stocks like Amazon up, I think, 73, 74% year-to-date versus a lot of these other benchmarks that are still actually in negative territory for the year. Those divergences typically point to a bigger correction down the road. So that's kind of what we're on the lookout for, you know, within maybe the next 1 to 3 months, perhaps a little bit bigger correction than we've seen thus far. Now, the forces against us and fighting against this divergence that I'm talking about is probably even stronger, and that's liquidity. I'm sure you've had other guests on your programs. I'm sure you're watching it yourself. The sheer amount of liquidity that's being injected into the global financial markets is unprecedented. This is a playbook that the Fed has learned coming out of the 08-09 financial crisis. Dollar dominance and having the dollar as the de facto global reserve currency, I think, allows the central bank to be aggressive on its stimulus efforts, its relief efforts, and inject massive amounts of liquidity into the system. Stocks love liquidity. Financial assets love liquidity. And when you inject such unprecedented amounts into the system, you have this reaction in stocks. So the big battle lines that I think are being drawn over the short run are this new economy leadership versus the broader markets, which still needs, you know, they still got some work to do in order to confirm a lot of these moves. You know, is this divergence going to persist? Is it going to lead to a much bigger correction than we've seen thus far? That's on the one side versus, right, federal government and central bank relief and stimulus efforts. Now, we know that Congress folks are trying to give themselves an imposed deadline of tomorrow to come out with some new stimulus measures, at least some data that the markets can chew on. But it's going to be a big wild card. And if the Fed continues to print in this aggressive nature, you're going to continue to see a bid underneath this market, even despite these divergences that I've talked about. So the big thing here is liquidity and what this experiment leads to years down the road. But for now, clearly inflationary for equity prices. What we've been telling our investors is, even though we are watching these divergences between, you know, leadership sectors like tech or consumer discretionary, the rest of the markets, you don't want to fight the tape. You certainly don't want to fight an accommodative Fed here right now.
Dan, I want to talk about, do you have any concern where you take a look at how technology, and as you talked about the NASDAQ up 22%, where you have the S&P technology portion of the index making up almost 30%, where it's really been this divergent economy where technology, I mean, we just saw last week the breakout in the sales, whether you're looking at Amazon, whether you were looking at Apple, whether you're looking at Google, Facebook, all these companies are blowing out their earnings estimates. I mean, Amazon was a complete blowaway. Does that concern you?
Well, so it's interesting you say that, right? So as of yesterday, 415 companies out of the S&P 500 got through their earnings, right? And 85% of that had beats. And our last earnings season, that number was around 67, 68%. So this is clearly a blowout quarter. I think that comps are very low, given what expectations were on the other side of the crash. My thinking is that aside from stimulus and liquidity propping up the markets, this earnings season is also propping up the markets. And once we get through to the other side of this, if you have more macro uncertainty, say elections, or what fiscal relief programs are going to look like, so on and so forth, as people start to look at the broader economy underneath, I think, you know, that outlook, given what we're seeing in terms of this market divergence on a technical basis, right, new economy versus broader markets, I think that could be a trigger of a bigger correction post-earnings season. So it is concerning to me. I think it, in a way, misrepresents what the broader economy is actually going through, and that's a much, much slower recovery, extremely sluggish. I know that the continuing claims, initial claims numbers were out today, but those are seasonal factors that caused the drop. You got to look for the last 4 months, million people each week coming on to the unemployment rolls. This is a big deal. And if stimulus efforts don't remain aggressive, you're going to see a major, in my opinion, a major slowdown in consumer discretionary spending, which has been one of the huge drivers keeping this thing afloat. So again, post earnings, post what we see on the other side of decisions with further relief and stimulus efforts, given this divergence in the markets, I think we can see some volatility ahead this year. I think it could come around the election season.
Let's take a look at another asset class, and let's talk about the precious metals. You know, I'm looking at a chart of silver, which looks like a NASA space launch. You look at gold, it's looking the same.
Really, the indication to me is some type of inflationary pressures ahead. And you said something at the beginning, which I thought was very interesting, because it's a thread that we've been working with here that I think a lot of people don't realize. You know, when money supply is fixed and the Fed, let's say, is accommodative, but not, you know, super easy, super accommodative, yet sort of, you know, a standard fixed money supply, you can see greater rotation in between asset classes and even investment strategies, right? And we can track that using like relative strength charts. You know, are bonds performing better than equities? Are commodities performing better? You know, which sector is performing best? What we've seen and why this is unprecedented, our theory is that so much liquidity has been showered on. There's effectively too much cash on the sidelines being funneled into the system. And quite frankly, not enough parking spaces in the financial markets. And so what you're effectively seeing is every strategy is seeing money flow rotate into it. And it's one of the first times we've seen this. Because the telltale sign is that as silver is breaking out and gold is making, you know, new highs here, we're watching bond yields press lower and lower. And what's happening is the bond market is non-confirmation on economic recovery, but the precious metals markets are clearly signaling some type of inflation ahead. So what does that tell you is a potential recipe? Could see some stagflation ahead, because as unemployment remains very high here and the economy is slow to recover, remember, we were working at labor participation rates of about 83% out of, let's say, boomer, Gen Xer, and millennial, and that's about 68% of the entire population. That has dropped down considerably. So even though you see these sort of inflationary pressures on the supply side, on the money supply side, wages, we're not going to see any inflation there. So that, to me, sets up very slow, if not zero economic growth against potential stagflationary forces. I think what the silver and gold markets, the precious metal markets, are suggesting to us is potential inflation ahead, potential stagflation. When I factor in what the job market, what the unemployment picture here looks like, the overall economy, plus what the bond market is doing. So what does that tell us where we can go? You know, silver prices, certainly on a short-term basis, any technician would tell you looking at the charts, you know, very overbought. So we would typically anticipate some type of profit taking a pullback in that market. However, what I would ask everybody to do on the silver charts, don't look at the daily charts, look at the long-term monthly charts, and you will see that silver effectively broke out of a base that dates back to maybe 2014, 2015. So you're working with about a five-year base or bottom in that metal. That tells me that this turn in silver could be longer, could be a bigger move than we think. So we're right now advocating, you know, be buyers on pullbacks of silver prices. You can use the SLV, which is the ETF that does a pretty good job of tracking spot silver prices. But silver prices right now trading at 28.7. You could see a pullback into low 20s on a short-term basis. So be careful chasing here, but we're buyers in the 20s. In terms of gold prices, same thing. I you know, when I look at relative strength, so we've got the silver-gold ratio. Silver, to me, looks like an ongoing winner on a relative basis, maybe not necessarily over the short run, but I think there's more to travel there. So again, we like silver. We like that monthly base, and silver prices really just breaking out last month. Gold prices, again, a very bullish chart. That base of bottoming effort goes back to around the same time period, 2014-2015, but gold has effectively been running since late 2018, whereas silver just broke out about 2 months ago. So gold has been in a run for several months now. It looks very overbought. I think any pullbacks that would hold down, even as far down as 1800 in that metal, are very bullish. I think investors should buy it. And what we do is we take that base and the breakout, which we would now measure back to 2011, and we calculate. Again, this is a guesstimate, but we calculate what's called a measured move out of the size and depth of that base and effort and gold prices, and it renders for me a target in the low 3,000 zone. So I do believe on an intermediate to longer term basis, despite my concern for very heated precious metals markets here that are likely to pull back, I think we're probably going to see gold prices go to about 3,000 in maybe a year's worth of time.
Wow. So, Dan, as we close, what would you be telling investors to do with metals? The thing that I would caution people, and I think you would tell them the same, when you see these breakouts and these parabolic rises, there's a tendency to go chase it because you think it's going higher, which it probably is, but you'd be better off waiting for a pullback because when they go straight up, there's always a pullback.
Yeah, the stronger that trajectory, right, if these things go parabolic, ultimately, the pullback can be pretty crushing, especially, you know, if you're late money into that. Look, we've been telling investors that have sidelined cash looking to get in the stock markets to wait for a big pullback, and it hasn't come yet. I mean, that shows you how powerful liquidity is. So what we are telling investors is, look, if you got sidelined cash, you have no exposure to silver or gold, you can move in. You know, it's not a function of chasing this. We would be better buyers on pullbacks. Again, if gold pulls back below 2,000 and is in the 19, even the 1,800 range, we're good buyers there for sideline cash. Investors that want to go in here, we would say just lower your position size. It gives you a little bit of a foothold and some exposure into the precious metals, you know, region of the markets, without getting too extended as you chase. I agree with you. I think it's got a pullback, but I think folks should be buyers on that pullback. And anybody that wants to chase here, we're asking them to scale down their position size because things are very overbought.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Janney Montgomery Scott, how can they do so?
The best thing to do is drop me an email. My email address is D1Trobski, so that's D-W-A-N-T-R-O-B-S-K-I at Janney.com. And we'll get right back to you, but we'd love to hear from folks.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, stay safe. Thanks again, and come back and talk to us once again.
Thanks very much. Have a great day. Have a great weekend, too.
Next year could be an earthquake for global bond markets, and there is more upside ahead for precious metals. That's according to our next guest, Peter Bookvari, Chief Investment Officer at Blakely Advisory Group and also the editor of the Book Report.
I do think that we are headed next year for an inflationary period, and I'm pretty optimistic on not just the precious metals, but other things commodity related, and that the supply disruptions, the supply upheavals in supply chains are going to be lasting, and that when we do get that economic recovery sometime next year that's more in earnest than the second half of this year, there are going to be a lot of supply-demand imbalances, and it could be an earthquake for the world's global bond markets.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, there may be some uncertainty about the economy, but there doesn't seem to be any uncertainty over asset markets. Just look at the stock market. It's back in record territory if you look at the NASDAQ. And you even have bonds, which have rallied this year, along with the price of gold and other hard assets, one in particular, real estate. Joining us from CoreLogic is Dr. Frank Nadoff. And Dr., let's take a look at real estate prices. A friend of mine put his house up for sale, got three offers in 2 weeks, went and bought another house. He was offer number four, but he came in with cash, and he got it. All of that within 2 weeks. Is this the kind of action you're seeing in the housing market?
Oh, absolutely. Those are great anecdotes, too, because I keep hearing about them in markets all around the country. It's a real hot market right now. We have a very limited inventory of homes on the market for sale. So when they are coming on the market, it's pretty common to see multiple bids come in on the house, and that works to bid up prices. There are plenty of home buyers out there who are really motivated by the record low level of mortgage rates that we have. As you know, 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates are averaging rate around or just under 3%. It's a record low, and that is a big motivational factor for many home buyers.
Doctor, one of the things that we're seeing is not only this transaction I talked about, but do you find that this extends across the range of real estate? The papers here had two big sales go through. A rock star bought a home in La Jolla for $25 million, and Bill Gates bought another house on the beach for $48 million. Do you find it extends across, are the McMansions selling, or is this just a price range of, let's say, family homes that most people can afford to get into?
Generally, the demand is pretty much across different price segments. The strongest, though, is clearly for moderately priced homes, because the strong appetite to buy right now is coming from first-time home buyers. They're predominantly millennials, and the millennials are looking to enter into home ownership. So they're generally not out there looking for the million-dollar homes. They're looking for something like a starter home. And so that's where so much of the demand is. And that's also where there's such a shortage of inventory on the market for sale. So when we look at the pricing pressures in the marketplace, the pricing pressures are strongest for the lower priced homes. And some of the higher priced homes, they're selling too, but it's more likely that you'll see higher priced homes sit on the market longer before contracts come in. Whereas the moderately priced homes, that's where you see 3, 4, 5, 6 contracts come in right away and very, very short timeline on the market.
So when you take a look at this, one of the things that we're all experiencing, Doctor, is this kind of stay at home, work from home. I know our whole office has been working from home because of technology since March. Do you think that will be changing some of the aspects that people look for when they're shopping for a home? For example, a home office now may be more in demand with this kind of work from home thing that we're seeing. I mean, you have Google saying its employees can work from home to next summer. Facebook is saying the same. So it seems to be catching on. And I would think that a home office would be more in demand now as people shop for homes.
Yes, and I agree with that. And, we're beginning to hear anecdotally that that is what home buyers are looking for. They're looking for a little bit extra living space because they want to have a room that they can set aside for a home office. And they're also looking for less density where they live. So many of the first-time home buyers, they've been renting homes, they've been renting apartments, they've been in high-rise buildings. Many of them are looking for something that's less dense in population. So a low-rise building or maybe a standalone single-family detached. And the single-family detached house is more likely to have that extra room that they're looking for a home office.
So when you say less density, that would almost imply, doctor, that you would almost have to go out to the burbs to find that. Because I know here in town, a lot of the developments here, I call them rack and stack them. I mean, you know, basically two-story homes where you can look into your neighbor's backyard.
Yeah, I tell you, it's a really interesting development. You know, it wasn't that long ago, just a few years back, we were talking about how the millennials were shunning the suburbs and they all wanted to be downtown. They wanted to be where all the action is. And now that they've gotten a few years older and the, you know, the largest group of millennials now are just like turning 30 years of age. There's some older, some younger, but 30 years of age is the kind of the biggest number of millennials. They're beginning to have second thoughts about where they want to locate, especially if they want to have more space. They want to have that home office. Space is very, very expensive downtown. Space is a lot less expensive if you move out to the suburbs. So we're beginning to hear about, you know, families who are making that that decision. They've moved downtown several years ago, but now they're looking at buying out in the suburbs.
You know, and what about the trend? It's not only here in California where our freeways are just racked and stacked, but less so now with people staying at home, but also some of the turmoil and some of the anarchy that we're seeing in some of the big cities, whether you're going to Portland, Seattle, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia. How much of an impact is that weighing, you know, sort of trying to get away from that and get in an area where not only you have space, but you feel safer?
Well, that's probably a factor for some families in some of those markets that have been so impacted. Because I do think people like to have safety, security, and also be able to have a little more control about their environment. That's something perhaps you can achieve if you move out of the downtown area and you move into a suburban community.
Doctor, are you finding at CoreLogic that there's a migration trend? I know just with a lot of my clients who are retiring in California, I would say almost 40% of them now are choosing to sell the big house here and move to areas or other states where the cost of living and the taxation is low. High on the list is Arizona, Nevada, Texas. Are you seeing an inner migration in the country from not only the West Coast, but the East Coast?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People are looking to move where they can lower their housing costs, especially if you're maybe a baby boomer and you're considering retirement, or maybe you have just retired. You may want to relocate to an area where you can lower your housing costs. You may want to move to an area where you've got other family members. Maybe you're an empty nester and your kids have taken jobs in Texas or wherever. And so you want to be closer to them. So we have been seeing that trend where people have been moving from out of the really high cost, high tax locations to states that have lower costs, lower housing costs, and lower taxes.
So as this trend escalates, I want to go back to what we're seeing in real estate now as prices keep moving up. But in the last downturn where prices were, you know, stretched, I would say, almost bubble-like prices, they fell. One thing we did not see coming out of that recession and this recovery, we did not see another bubble in real estate. In fact, as you just mentioned, actually the supply has been kept tight. I know the builders here, instead of unlike the last decade where they would open up one or two, three phases on speculation in a housing development, here they're playing it close to the chest. They only open one phase at a time. Until it's sold, they don't open up another one. Explain what is going on the supply front, because it seems like if you can build it, they'll buy it.
I tell you, it's such a different economy that we're in now compared to 12, 13 years ago when we had the house price bubble. Back in 2006 and 7 when we had the house price bubble. We also had an overbuilt market. It's radically different now. Now we have an underbuilt market. And I think builders are a bit more cautious because so many of them remember how badly they were burned not too long ago with the house price bubble and the Great Recession. We've also seen some increases in local regulatory costs, the costs of getting permits, the cost of paying impact fees in local jurisdictions. All of that just translates into higher house prices for newly built homes. And in order for a builder to kind of be able to make their own margin, they need to build more expensive homes. I think that's a part of why we've seen a shortage of homes, especially in the low-priced segment. Again, there seems to be ample supply of homes, in the multi-million-dollar price range. It's the more moderately priced homes that builders used to build in that segment many years ago. That's a segment that, in particular, today has a significant shortage of availability.
You know, Doctor, the thing that really surprises me, I never, ever dreamed when I bought my first home where the mortgage rate was close to 9%, and then eventually they get as high as 12% on one mortgage that we had. I never dreamed in my day that I would ever see a mortgage at 3%. I had a client that just got a 10-year ARM that was fixed for 10 years at 2.6%. I mean, at these kind of mortgage rates, how much is that adding to, let's say, the demand for housing? Because it certainly, in terms of the cost of housing, makes it so much more affordable.
Oh, absolutely. Mortgage rates on average for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage in the most recent week, 2.99%. And
wow,
there are some lenders that are quoting lower rates than that for a 30-year fixed rate loan, especially if you have a good credit history and you're putting a sizable down payment on to buy the home. You can even get a lower rate. So it's a phenomenal time for anybody shopping for a mortgage. Mortgage rates today for 30-year fixed rate are 0.75 percentage point lower than they were 1 year ago. That means that really enhances the affordability to buy, because that monthly principal and interest payment is substantially lower to buy a moderately priced home today compared to just 1 year ago.
So, you know, as we sort of conclude here, Doctor, what would you advise? Let's take three situations. A millennial family who's, you know, maybe they have children now and they're thinking of finally owning a home, leaving the inner city. Somebody wanting to trade up, perhaps they find with all this, you know, quarantine, they need a bigger home. And then finally, a couple that are nearing retirement, want to sell the big house and trade down. What would you tell all three?
Mortgage rates are cheap right now, so this is an excellent opportunity to take advantage of extremely low interest rates. The important thing is to make sure you know what the attributes are in the home that you want to buy. And those attributes are not just the size of the home, whether or not it should have extra room for a work from home office, but also what's the local school district like, if schools are important, if you have school age kids, and what are the other amenities that are in the areas that you want to buy. So you have to do your homework first on your end to identify what those attributes are that you're looking for in your next home, and then just go out and see what's on the market. There are plenty of homes on the market available for sale. Many of them are not on the market very long. Some are just days and some are just hours on the market before they get scoffed up. So it is important to know what you're looking for and then work with an agent and see what's available on the market.
So, Doctor, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work and the kind of things you do at CoreLogic, tell them a little bit about your website and your services, please.
Sure. So CoreLogic is a real estate technology and data analytics company. CoreLogic is headquartered in Irvine, California. Our website is www.corelogic.com. We have an insights page where we put up a lot of our thought leadership blogs, our information about trends in the marketplace. So if you Google CoreLogic and my last name, Notaft, that'll take you to a webpage where you can see some of my latest observations about the housing and mortgage market.
All right. Well, listen, Doctor, as always, thanks for joining us on the program, updating us on the real estate. So it looks like prices could head higher, and it's still a good time to buy, especially with low mortgage rates. All the best to you, and come back and talk to us again.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Smart Macro. As always, we are joined today by Financial Sense Wealth Management's CIO, Chris Poplava. Chris, I want to talk to you about something that Dan Wentropski brought up earlier in our show. One thing that he said that I thought was pretty notable is how, as we all know, tech is just dominating the markets right now, and there's a pretty meaningful divergence between tech and the rest of the sectors, the rest of the economy. And he said that, you know, this divergence can persist, but he likened it to what we've seen in periods around 98, 99, and then also in 06, 07. So let's start there. What's your technical take on the market, since I know that you do watch a wide range of different technical measures as well?
Well, you know, like Dan, I am seeing some concerning signs. One of them being, you know, if you look at 1 month new highs, they're starting to diverge with price. 3 month new highs starting to diverge. But if you look at 52-week highs, you know, those were still expanding and confirming the market move into the latter part of July. But recently we've seen some, a little bit of divergence in 52-week new highs. So it does kind of tell me the market's thinning here a little bit. And we could have a pullback. You know, one area that it really leans in that kind of assessment is looking at the percent of stocks above their 50-day moving average. And that really has been diverging with the market ever since June. Whether you're looking at the S&P or the NASDAQ or other types of indices, we are seeing a decline in the percent of stocks above their moving average. So it does tell me that we are starting to weaken here a little bit. In terms of breadth, so, you know, whenever you're seeing only a handful of stocks carrying the market, you're always susceptible to some kind of a pullback. But in terms of a major top, I don't think we're, you know, this is similar to, you know, 98, 99, or even 2006, 2007. And the main reason why I say that is back in 1999, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. You know, we were below 5% in 99, and the Fed raised it all the way up till 6.5%. And then also in 2000, that was when the Fed stopped printing money with Y2K, and they started to slow the rate of their expansion of their balance sheet. And same thing with 2006, 2007. In that, you know, time period, we had Ben Bernanke raising interest rates, and that was seen as tightening financial conditions. We have the opposite. I mean, we've got record amount of money printing by the Fed, and the Fed said they're not even thinking about raising rates. And I think the market right now is pricing in maybe the first hike at least 2 years out. So from that standpoint, you know, those other two time periods that Dan mentioned, the Fed was a headwind, not a tailwind, and it's clearly a tailwind now. You know, in those other periods, we weren't just coming out of a recession. Those were periods after multiple years of expansion. So I think that is probably the biggest difference, but I would absolutely agree with Dan. The market is a little bit unhealthy. You don't want to see only one sector or a handful of stocks carrying everything. So I do agree that there is some potential weakness, but I wouldn't say we should expect a major top. markets usually correct several times a year. I think the last stat that I saw, something like, you know, the market has several 5% pullbacks a year, and I think a 10% correction maybe once every 10 months or so on average. So stocks are volatile, commodities even more so. We shouldn't be surprised that volatility works both up and down. We've been blessed with seeing it on the upside, but you know, there's also the possibility of seeing some volatility on the downside, particularly with the upcoming elections. You know, usually leading to an election, the market's pretty volatile. So, you know, I would not be surprised at least to see the market pull in here a little bit.
Another place that we've discussed on the show with you in the past is the credit markets. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing from that angle?
Back in 1998, 1999, also in 2006 and 2007, because the Fed was raising interest rates and was tightening financial conditions, that was being reflected in the credit markets. So if you looked at junk bonds or investment grade bonds, you were starting to see spreads begin to pick up. And spread is really just looking at, for a comparable maturity treasury, how much more yield are you getting in corporate bonds versus a risk-free asset like a treasury. And when people get wary and worried about their future and outlook, they require compensation for additional perceived risk, and that compensation comes with additional yield. And so when we do see credit spreads begin to rise, that is a basically a shot across the bow that, you know, not everything is moving in the right direction. And we certainly saw credit spreads begin to widen in 2006 and 2007, and also in 1999 and 2000. But presently, credit spreads peaked in March with a significant decline that we saw. But they've been confirming the direction of the market. You know, as the market moves higher, we've seen a general decline in credit spreads, whether you're looking at credit default swaps or spreads relative to treasuries. So to me, that's an encouraging sign that essentially the credit markets are kind of seeing the same tune as the stock market. And for that reason, you know, I think this isn't, you know, 2006 or 7 or even the late 1990s blow off period.
Another thing that Dan mentioned was his outlook on gold and silver. Of course, this is something we've been discussing with you now for many, many months, given the fact that you've been explaining to our listeners that we took a pretty significant allocation to both gold and silver. I believe that was last year in 2019 when we began that, and then a silver allocation earlier this year. Did I get that correct?
That's correct. For all of our clients last year, outside of those, are only fixed income. We bought a initial position in gold, and we built and doubled that position. But seeing the huge discount that silver had to gold, still being bullish in precious metals, we felt there's more opportunity in silver. So we sold half of our gold position to allocate to silver. And for a few more of our aggressive accounts, we bought precious metals mining stocks because of our bullish outlook.
Okay, so what Dan had said is he thinks that we could see gold go as high as within a year's time to the low 3,000s. That's the current price target that they have based on the technical setup. And he also says silver could go considerably higher as well. However, I think the big message, key takeaway from that was that, you know, I mean, they've just been going straight up, especially this week and last week. A little bit of cooling off perhaps on the day that you and I are speaking, which is Friday, August 7th. But that said, what's your current outlook on gold and silver and anything that we're doing here at our company, Financial Sense Wealth Management, in that area in particular?
One of the things we do every single week is we look at all of our holdings, and we look at those that look attractive and those that maybe are too extended. And we do that just to allocate to clients who are new to us or who add to their accounts. That way, we're always making sure we're keeping track of our positions and that client accounts are where they should be. But, you know, over the last several weeks, we've kind of had a bit of a buying strike in terms of precious metals, given how extended they are. We didn't want to chase the market higher. And for some of our clients or larger clients who have a huge exposure to precious metals, we did do some hedging earlier this week for some select clients that have, again, outsized positions. And for that, for the reason for this is just the massive move in silver. You know, it's incredible that the gold silver ratio, you know, how high gold is priced relative to silver, hit an all-time high this year in March and 124 times. And we have seen a huge collapse in the gold silver ratio. Silver has just gone through the roof. And I do think we're likely to see a period of cooling here. You know, one of the things I looked at, as mentioned, is the gold silver ratio, is I also look at the rate of change of that ratio. So how fast it's moving in either direction. And over the last 90 days, we've seen the gold silver ratio plummet by over 35%. That is a very sharp drop in a short amount of time. And I wanted to go back and see historically, whenever we've seen that happen, when has it happened, and kind of what are the, what's been the fallout after that? And we've seen that a couple of times, as I mentioned. We, one of the first times we saw that, or the most recent time, was in 1998, and essentially silver went had a huge jump. It was in the low single digits. 97 was close to around $4 an ounce, and it surged to over $7 an ounce going into 98, while gold was undergoing a little bit of a decline. So gold and silver were diverging from each other, and that's what really drove the gold-silver ratio to see such a drop as silver outperformed gold. But after 98, we had the Russian ruble crisis. Gold came back and started to solidify, while silver sold off given its industrial component. And 98 seen a sharp sell-off in risk assets with the implosion of long-term capital management. So the returns for silver were pretty negative once it had that huge outperformance to gold. But going back a little bit further, the next time that we saw that, looking back in history, was in early 1980. When silver handedly outperformed gold. It didn't mark the end of the precious metals bull market. That happened a few months later, and the ratio started to go up again because silver wasn't moving up as much as gold going into that latter part of January of 1980. But it did signify a top, both for gold and silver, but that came after a prolonged bull market. So it's very interesting in the present case, we're seeing this massive surge in silver relative to gold. And this isn't coming after a multi-year bull market in precious metals. We've seen gold, obviously really strengthen over the last year or so, and silver's kind of bounced around, hasn't really gone as far because we've had a slowdown in the global economic growth, and silver has an industrial component to it. But the massive surge in silver is we haven't seen something like this, as I mentioned, in the beginning of a bull market. Usually it comes after a prolonged period. So for this reason, I don't think that this is a sign that this is the end, basically a blow off top in silver and obviously in precious metals. But I do think what this is going to signify is a cooling period. I think we've gone a little bit too far, too fast, and I wouldn't be surprised to see precious metals cool off here during the month of August. But, for the very simple reason of knowing what monetary policy is going to be like for the next, several years, I would be very hard-pressed to make a case that the precious metals bull market is over. I mean, we know the Fed is going to continue to add trillions to its balance sheet. Other central banks are printing money. And there is no one even close to think about raising rates in any country. So for that matter, I do not think the precious metals bull market is over, but I do expect a period of digestion here. So I think putting money to work in precious metals could be fairly risky at current levels.
If there was a new client were to come in and we were to invest their money and allocate it into various sectors, how would you end up allocating that money given the current landscape as you see it?
The nice thing about having a portfolio, not just a few, ETFs, but an actual full portfolio, both on the equity side as well as the fixed income side, is there's usually, and that's the beauty of diversification. The idea of diversification is you always want to have something working. You don't want to have all of your eggs in one basket. And so for us, as I mentioned earlier, every week we go through what we would buy. And so by having that constant attention to our holdings, we have a good sense of what looks attractive, what's doing well. And there's right now, I think, as I mentioned, in general, the market looks a little vulnerable to a pullback. So I'd probably want to go slow and take advantage of any market dip, particularly in precious metals. But we have several holdings that look really attractive, some deep value plays in the consumer staples sector, as well as some industrial stocks that have gotten unbelievably cheap with the decline this year, plus the overall decline since the global economy peaked back in late 17, 2018. So I buy some of our deep value plays. I think they look really good. One of them that we own, I was mentioning Barron's, it's starting to perform well today. But we have some 5G plays that to me look still attractive at this point. And the other area we're starting to invest for our clients is convertible bonds. And the reason for that is if you look at where interest rates are, both on the short and long end, they're at generational lows. And to me, what is the likelihood that rates are going to go into negative territory here in the U.S.? I think that's very slim. So in terms of the upside for investing in bonds, especially long-term bonds, I see that as more limited. And I think the downside for investing in bonds is significantly higher because I think interest rates over time are more likely to rise than fall. That coupled with what's going on in terms of monetary policy, the Fed is printing trillions of dollars. I think we're going to see asset inflation. And I think, you know, just go look at the stock market after QE 1, 2, and 3. And it was pretty clear how the stock market reacted to that. And I think that's part of the reason why stocks have done so well. And I think they'll continue to do well in the years to come is all of the asset inflation we're going to get from money printing. So from that standpoint, one of the ways I like to play that is with convertible bonds, where essentially we can get good interest from a bond, but there's essentially an embedded call option that if the bond does, or if the underlying stock does exceed a certain price in the coming years, then we can convert that bond into the actual equity. And so you can have some phenomenal returns on convertible bonds if the stock takes off. And if it doesn't, well, then it's effectively a corporate bond. So I'm still very attracted to some of the corporate bonds we've been buying, especially in the healthcare space, and then also some of the deep value plays that we have.
Well, Chris, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you to discuss how we could help them on the corporate bond side, the corporate cash account, or any of the other services that we offer, what would be the best way to get a hold of you?
They can send me an email at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can call our office, and our number is 888-486-3939. If they'd like to talk to me directly, my extension is 106.
Chris, we look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour and our Smart Macro segment with Chris Paplava. Again, if you'd like to give him a call to discuss his investment outlook or to speak with any of our financial advisors, you can do so by giving us a call at 888-486-3939. And also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour and the wide range of guest experts, investment strategists, and book authors that we speak with on a regular basis, some of the top thinkers in the industry. Again, we do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcast during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.